government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Tuesday vowed to go ahead with a military operation in the southern Gaza city of Rafah, despite international concern over the fate of more than 1 million Palestinians sheltering there. The U.S. State Department said that the United States has not seen a credible Israeli plan for the operation that would address its concerns.
Rafah is a region with more than 1 million people seeking refuge. It's an area that continues to be an important conduit for humanitarian aid, as well as a safe departure for foreign nationals. And so any kind of operation that does not address some of these key concerns would certainly be opposed by us.
Deputy spokesperson Vedant Patel. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Tuesday that there has been incremental progress toward averting an entirely preventable human-made famine in the northern Gaza Strip.
But much more is urgently needed, including the promised opening of the two crossing points between Israel and northern Gaza, so that aid can be brought into Gaza from Ashdod port and Jordan.
Guterres also said that a major obstacle to distributing aid across Gaza is the lack of security for humanitarian workers. People in Sudan have been resorting to extreme measures as a hunger crisis spreads among a year-old war, and aid agencies warn of the risk of famine there. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration will move to reclassify marijuana with a less dangerous drug, a historic shift to generations of America drug policy that could have wide ripple effects across the country. The Justice Department proposal still must be reviewed by the White House Office of Management and Budget. This is VOA News. The top UN court rejected Tuesday a request by Nicaragua to order Germany to halt military and other aid to Israel and renew funding to the UN aid agency in Gaza. The International Court of Justice said that legal conditions for making such an order were not met and ruled against the request in a 15-1 vote, effectively siding with Germany, which told judges that it's barely exporting any arms to Israel. However, the 16-judge panel declined to throw out the case altogether, as Germany had requested. The court will still hear arguments from both sides of the merits of Nicaragua's case, which alleges that by giving support to Israel, Germany failed to prevent genocide. And again, people in Sudan have been resorting to extreme measures as a hunger crisis spreads amid a year-old war, and aid agencies warn of the risk of famine. Reuters correspondent David Doyle.
As starvation set in amid Sudan's year-long civil war, Lina Mohammed Hassan's family resorted to extreme measures to survive.
The children were collecting tree leaves and eating them. They took mango leaves and ate them.
The Famine Early Warning Systems Network, a global authority on food insecurity, reported in March that areas of Khartoum are at risk of famine. And it's not just the capital. With the conflict between the army and the RSF showing no sign of abating, hunger and starvation is spreading across the country. At some refugee camps in North Darfur, residents, medics and aid workers say people have resorted to eating soil and leaves.
That's Reuters' David Doyle reporting. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has been held in contempt of court for violating a gag order in his hush money case and ordered to pay a $9,000 fine. AP correspondent Julie Walker.
The ruling, a rebuke for the Republican former president who had insisted he was exercising his free speech rights and on his way into court before the ruling spoke out.
This is a hoax. This is a judge who's conflicted. Badly, badly, badly conflicted. I've never seen a judge so conflicted. And giving us virtually no rulings.
Manhattan prosecutors say Trump and his associates took part in an illegal scheme to influence the 2016 presidential campaign by burying negative stories. He has pleaded not guilty. Julie Walker, New York.
You'll find more at voanews.com. Again, voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbote in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The United Kingdom sanctions the Speaker of Uganda's Parliament and two other lawmakers for alleged corruption.
The fact that the Speaker is being sanctioned by another country, to some extent, does downplay the efforts of Uganda in the fight against corruption.
Corruption grip on road infrastructure slows Malawi's development. Botswana's diamond industry gets a boost amid global uncertainty. Togo's opposition says Monday's election did not go well when it comes to transparency and participation. Rwandan opposition leader Victoire Ingabire petitions the East Africa Court of Justice to restore her civil liberties.
I asked the Eastern African Court to take interim measures that accord me the right to participate in the election. So I hope that the court will accept my request.
And South Africa prepares to end captive bred lion hunting. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Kingdom government has sanctioned the Speaker of Uganda's Parliament, Anita Among, and two lawmakers under its anti-corruption laws, according to official documents published on Tuesday. The document alleges that Among and the other two lawmakers, Mary Kitutu and Agnes Nandutu, former ministers for the Karamoja region, will be subject to travel bans and asset freezes under the UK's global anti-corruption sanctions regime. The two are accused of having stolen thousands of iron sheets from a government-funded housing project aimed at helping vulnerable communities in Karamoja. Douglas Mpuga reached Sisi Kagaba, a lawyer and the former executive director of the Anti-Corruption Coalition Uganda, for her reaction to these sanctions.
I would say that the sanctioning is a welcome move because there was a lot of public outcry against issues of the iron sheets, but also there were reports that were produced by the same government. The fact that the speaker is being sanctioned by another country, to some extent, does downplay the efforts of Uganda in the fight against corruption, because we should have seen our country. Of course, we know Minister Nandutu was already in court. The two ministers, I think, were in court, but of course, we know nothing much had happened to the speaker. So the fact that we see another country coming in and imposing sanctions, I think that speaks volumes as to probably the levels of impunity that you have in the country. Do we see selective application of the law? That is just another issue, because the report was produced and a number of individuals were mentioned. However, we only saw a few individuals that were ever prosecuted. And we believe that by the time countries like the UK come up and put sanctions, they have overwhelming evidence, which evidence I actually believe that our government already has.
There has been a lot of attention or concern about the Ugandan Parliament misusing public funds. Recently, they even suggested increasing their remunerations and allowances. Could that have tipped the whole thing to focus attention on the corruption?
You see, the issue of Parliament increasing the emolument is something that a civil society has made noise over. And I think it is an abuse of the powers of Parliament. For me, I believe that our Parliament has become a great liability to Ugandans. It is not the first time. And I mean, if you read and go backward, you realize that Parliament over time has abused its mandate to extract and to continuously milk all the little resources that we see Ugandans having, and they've continuously decided to enrich themselves. So it isn't surprising when we see some of these sanctions coming to play. However, we need to be cautious that despite the fact that these sanctions have come, are we going to see a change in the way Parliament does its business? I highly doubt.
But what do you say to those who claim that the Ugandan Parliament is in cahoots with the executive, and whatever they do, the executive is aware and approves of it?
Obviously they are, because we need to know that Parliament has lost its independence. It has lost its independence. And also remember that there's a mix whereby you have members of Parliament. At the same time, members of Parliament are also, some of them are ministers. So the same members of Parliament sit in Cabinet, and then they also come in Parliament. And again, this is one of the things that we have continuously talked about, because where do we see the doctrine of separation of powers, especially where you're seeing members of Parliament being ministers at the same time. Remembering that you are supposed to have three arms of government, but in most cases, the executive and the executive and parliament have to some extent been fused together. So it isn't surprising when allegations come up that the two arms, especially cabinet and parliament, are in cahoots.
Sizi Kagaba is a lawyer and the former executive director of the Anti-Corruption Coalition of Uganda. She spoke from Kampala with VOA's Douglas Mpuga. Uganda Parliament spokesperson Chris Obori was not available for an interview, but in a statement he said the allegation against the speaker was a ruse to conceal what he calls the real and unstated reason for the sanctions, which he says is to condemn the speaker among for enacting Uganda's Anti-Homosexuality Act. Economic and accountability bodies in Malawi are urging the government to address flaws in the public procurement system. A 2021 Malawi Assurance Report on Public Infrastructure Projects suggests pervasive corruption in Malawi's public sector. The construction industry is particularly affected. Chimwewe Padeta has the story from Lilongwe.
Potholes and other road defects are an integral part of the daily urban experience. Beyond posing a threat to drivers and their passengers, they represent one of the impediments to the socio-economic development of a country.
The current condition of the road is increasing vehicle costs over time.
As a result of the deteriorating road condition, motorists take 3 hours travel between Lilongwe and Kasungu, a distance that was initially covered in less than 2 hours. Economist Beth Sapiri is adamant that the country's road infrastructure has affected economic growth.
If we do have a good road infrastructure, what it entails is that the social and economic development can flourish so easily, because the roads have a potential actually to stimulate the volume of trade, opening up of new markets, attracting more investors actually.
Accountability and transparency bodies are pointing out flaws in public procurement systems that enable bribery, allowing unqualified construction firms to secure major contracts.
We have seen contracts being awarded to individuals who do not have even a single machinery, a single company. We have also seen infrastructure projects that are of substandard simply because there was collusion between government officials and contractors, and the result is delivery of poor infrastructure projects.
In response to growing concerns about the condition of the country's roads, Minister of Transport and Public Works Jacob Hara has reassured Malawians of swift rehabilitation efforts. Against this background, the Construction Industry Regulator, the National Construction Industry Council of Malawi, NCIC, has upped its game, providing supervision on existing projects.
There are circumstances that lead to poor quality of infrastructure, one of which would be corruption. Some projects have actually failed at conception. The way the project is conceived, it is already a failure. Sometimes they fail at procurement.
The industry regulator has started issuing stop orders on construction projects that have breached contractual agreements in line with the National Construction Industry Act. Commuters say urgent actions are needed to fix the existing road network and ensure the implementation of the country's ambitions. Malawi envisions creating a multi-modal transport system by year 2063. One of the key components of the plan is to have well-maintained and upgraded roads connecting urban and rural areas. Chimwewe Padata, VOA News, Lilongwe.
Rwandan opposition leader Victoire Ingabire Umuhoza has petitioned the East Africa Court of Justice to restore her civil liberties, which she says were taken away by the government, including the right to participate in the July 24 election. Ingabire has been denied participation in the polls because she has been convicted and imprisoned. However, she said that she had also been pardoned by President Paul Kagame. Ingabire Umuhoza tells me that she wants the court to act quickly to restore her rights to travel and participate in any elections.
Yes, I go in the court to seek justice because Rwanda, there is a lack of dependence of the court in Rwanda. And as you know, in March, I was seeking to be rehabilitated by the High Court in Rwanda. And my application was dismissed because of lack of independence of the justice in our country. This is why I am looking justice in the Eastern African Court to recover my political and civil rights that I can participate in the next elections. And I have also my husband who is in the Netherlands and who is in Zurich, and I would like to visit him. And since I was released in 2018, I have no right to leave my country, so I cannot visit him. So this is why I am looking for justice.
You said you were seeking rehabilitation, but the High Court ruled against you. What kind of rehabilitation were you seeking?
You know, when I come back in my country in 2010 to participate in the presidential election, a few months later I was arrested and I was involved in the political process. And I was condemned for 15 years. So I spent 8 years in prison, out of which 5 years I spent in the isolated confinement. And I was released by the presidency in pardon in 2018, so after 8 years. But when I was condemned, I made appeal to the African Court on Human and the People Rights to clear my name, but the Rwanda government refused to recognize the decision of the African Court.
Yeah, you know that Rwanda is going to hold elections in July this year, and you were denied participation in those elections because, according to the Rwandan government, you are being convicted. Now, you would like for the EACJ to do what? To restore your right to participate?
Yes, I asked the ECJ to accord to rehabilitate me in my rights that I can participate in the elections. And I asked the Eastern African Court to take interim measures, urgent measures that accord me the right to participate in the elections. So I hope that the court will accept my request and that they will order the Rwanda government to let me to participate in the elections.
You mentioned your husband. Can you travel out of Rwanda?
No, when I was released in 2018, one of the conditions under the release on parole was that I can't leave my country without the authorization of the Minister of Justice.
Madam, are you confident that you will get a desirable results from the EAC court?
Yes, I am confident because the decision of the High Court in Rwanda that refused me to be rehabilitated violated the treaty established by the Eastern African community. And all countries, members of the East African community, they have to respect the treaty they have signed. Every member of this community has to respect the human rights, the rule of law.
Rwandan opposition leader Victoire Ingabire was speaking with us from the capital, Kigali. The Rwandan government was not immediately available to respond to Ingabire Umuhoza's court petition. However, the government has always maintained that its court system is independent and fair. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 1st. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. A member of the Togolese Diaspora Coalition says Monday's parliamentary election, when taken from the perspective of participation and transparency, did not go well. The government says that the vote was free and fair and without violence. Results are expected anytime this week. Bridget Akuvi Amigambi is a member of the board of Synergy Togo, a Togolese diaspora organization based in Europe. She tells me that the election authorities denied accreditation to the Episcopal Commission for Justice and Peace and other local election observer groups.
The election went well if we use the only metric which is used by the government members since the election of 2005, who brought Faure Gnassingbé in power in Togo. They will say it went well because it was without violence. And violence is now the only metric that evaluates the elections in Togo. No one talk about participation rate. No one talk about transparency. No one talk again about the elections being free and fair. If you take the other metrics, which are, first of all, participation rate, it was very low according to all the people that were in the voting offices. The estimation in Lomé, which is the biggest city, is around 30%, 3-0, which means that 70% of Togolese people that had the chance to be registered on the election list chosen to not to go to the poll because the government that organized this poll is considered that government to be both illegal and illegitimate. This is something worrying because many people reported that there were a number of people in the voting offices with pre-voted, which was trying to feed those bulletins into the voting cases.
But, Bridget, I did speak with a government minister, I would say a spokesperson, who said that the election was free and fair, that there were both local and international observers, including the African Union.
I haven't heard about any African Union observers, but I know that the ECOWAS observers that was part of a communique that came from ECOWAS a few weeks ago were invited by the government. So the government selected who he wants as observers, and in the contrary, the Episcopal Commission for Justice and Peace, who was preparing to deploy 500 observers, has seen his accreditation refused. And another local group of observers who was preparing to deploy about 180 observers also obtained an accreditation at the beginning. But 2 days before the election, his accreditation was cancelled as well.
Bridget Akubi Amigambi is a member of the board of Senagi Togo, a Togolese diaspora organization in Europe. She was speaking with us from Paris, France. Botswana's diamond trade is on the rise despite industry uncertainty over efforts to sanction Russian stones. De Beers has relocated its auction headquarters from Singapore to Botswana, while the Secretariat of the Kimberley Process, a trade regime that certifies rough diamond exports to eliminate trade in conflict gems, also moved to the African nation. Nkudise Dube reports from Habaruni.
De Beers, which has a long-standing sales agreement with Botswana, sells 10% of its diamonds through auctions. De Beers Executive Vice President Paul Rowley said the relocation of its auctions office is part of an effort to streamline its business operations and facilitate the further development of Botswana's diamond sector.
The auction platform coming across, it'll bring in some additional customers. It'll also enable us to possibly sell to smaller parcels. Auction sales will also offer the opportunity to sell to some smaller players. So perhaps some Botswana can also start to register and engage in that platform, which I think will be very exciting from that perspective.
The relocation comes as the diamond industry reels from effects of a traceability initiative introduced by the Group of Seven Leading Industrialized Countries, or G7, in a bid to sanction Russian diamonds. Under the arrangement, all diamonds entering G7 markets are routed through Antwerp, Belgium, to ascertain their origin. The tracking system, however, has caused disruptions to the supply chain, according to Rowley.
We continue to work closely with the G7 in trying to find a solution that we're concerned about are the unintended consequences of
the relocation of De Beers Auctions Office coincides with the Kimberley Process Secretariat commencing its operations in Botswana. The Kimberley Process is a global initiative by the diamond industry to eliminate trade in conflict gems. In mid-May, the Kimberley Process will hold its intersessional meeting in Dubai, where the G7's tracking system is expected to come under intense debate. The G7 countries and Russia are all members of the Kimberley Process. World Diamond Council President Feryl Zarouki told VOA that G7 traceability scheme needs to be reviewed.
The WDC believes that mechanisms for assuring a diamond's provenance should be efficient, effective, and equitable. However, we don't believe that the approach of a single Antwerp entry point meets this test.
Botswana's Minister of Minerals, Lefoko Moahi, meanwhile held the establishment of the Kimberley Process Secretariat in Gaborone.
The Kimberley Process is an international and multi-stakeholder organization comprising governments, the diamond industry, civil society, whereby we aim to increase ethical conduct in diamond trade. Therefore, this is very key for us.
Botswana is the world's second largest producer of diamonds after Russia and is leading calls for the G7 traceability initiative to be revised. Kondisi Dube, VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
South Africa's treatment of its big cats has long tarnished its reputation for conservation, from allowing captive-bred lion hunting to selling lion bones to East Asia for their purported medicinal qualities. But now, the country is ending all that. Kate Butler reports from Lions Rock Sanctuary in Free State Province.
These lions were bred for the bullet. Their destiny was to be killed by trophy hunters who pay thousands of dollars to take part in hunts where the animal has zero prospect of escape. Kwasi Kwenkosi Nayati, whose nickname is Excellent, works at the Lions Rock Big Cat Sanctuary.
The lion will be feeding, minding its own business, not aware that it will be killed on that day. They will use me to lure it closer, and then someone will just take a gun and shoot it and then pose for social media.
The lions at the sanctuary are some of the lucky ones. They were moved from a captive breeding facility.
They've been living the most comfortable life. As you know, everything comes with a silver platter to them.
South Africa has the biggest population of captive bred lions in the world. Some 8,000 according to the government, though NGOs put the figure higher, almost three times the number found in the wild. Fiona Miles is the director of Lions Rock and Four Paws South Africa, an animal welfare NGO. She says the captive lion breeding industry is a vicious cycle.
The lions are intensively bred, almost in a factory farming way. So lionesses are forced to breed. The cubs are taken away from them as soon as possible after birth. Those cubs are then used for interactions with paying guests or paying visitors.
Later, they are often used in so-called canned hunting. And there is also a whole industry around lion bones, which are used in traditional Chinese medicine, though South Africa hasn't allowed their export since 2019. A 2015 documentary called Blood Lions drew international outrage when it showed the cramped and filthy conditions in which some of the animals were kept. The reputational damage prompted South Africa's government to investigate shutting down the industry and set up a ministerial task team to provide recommendations. In March, the cabinet announced it was phasing out captive lion breeding. This will be done over an estimated two-year period, allowing lion breeders of the 342 facilities across the country to voluntarily exit the industry. With rules in place in the interim, Cam Chetty, who led the ministerial task team that made the recommendations, explains.
To close down an industry requires a long legislative process that has to go to two houses of parliament and has a tremendous amount of consultation.
Lion breeders must sterilize their animals and can reduce the number of big cats during that time through hunting or euthanasia. Stockpiles of lion bones will be burned to prevent their sale. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, in the Free State, South Africa.
South African police are investigating if former President Jacob Zuma's new political party forgot forged supporters' signatures to register for national elections next month. The Associated Press reports the MK party has been embroiled in legal cases over whether it and Zuma are eligible to contest the May 29 election. It could be the most pivotal vote in South Africa in the last 30 years. African Festival this Wednesday, May 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.